This is Sea Change Radio, covering the shift to sustainability. I'm Alex Wise.
At the end of the day, this is a waste management and a city issue. It's how we deal with our products and our waste. It's not the ocean that is creating the problem. It's our daily lives and our management of this material that is causing it to overflow, basically.
Doug Woodring is the founder of the Ocean Recovery Alliance. His name may sound familiar to longtime listeners of Sea Change Radio because we featured Woodring back in 2010 when he was leading Project Kaisei, a mission to gather information on and document the massive repository of plastic that has accumulated in the North Pacific Gyre. The Ocean Recovery Alliance is the next logical step on Woodring's path. The organization focuses on advocacy, raising awareness, and actually cleaning up the plastic floating in our world's oceans and interfering with marine ecosystems. Woodring provides a status update on oceanic health, walks us through some of the cost incurred by our global plastic habit, and tells us about what the Alliance and its projects are accomplishing to help us clean up our act and our oceans. I'm joined now on Sea Change Radio by the founder of the Ocean Recovery Alliance, Doug Woodring. Doug, welcome to Sea Change Radio.
Hi, Alex. How are you?
Good. Great to have you back on the show. We spoke almost 5 years ago, and folks can go listen to our conversation about Project Kaisei, which is not that dissimilar from what Ocean Recovery Alliance is focusing on, which is trying to remove waste and plastic from our oceans. You took a pretty unusual route to get to the environmental path that you're on now. Why don't you first give our listeners an overview of your career arc into the environmental world?
I grew up in California, so I was a competitive swimmer and water polo player, and started windsurfing at an early age, so I was always near the water. And when I moved to Asia, where I've worked for over 20 years, at that time Japan was booming. And I ended up with a job after an internship there with the largest fishing company in the world, or at least one of the largest. And I was the first foreigner to be working for them. And that gave me a lot of knowledge and insight onto how much scale is being taken out of the ocean, really without anyone noticing or paying attention. And, not only them, but every country taking large amounts from the ocean. And that sort of stuck with me. I then went back to graduate school and went into finance and was for 4 or 5 years in the asset management world. And I've always been really an entrepreneur at heart. And when the first Asian crisis came and everything we were doing really shrank in the finance world at the time in this region, I started doing entrepreneurial work in startups with technology and outdoor media technologies and environment. It wasn't until about 6 or 7 years ago I started getting really into environmental technology work and trying to help companies enter the market in Asia, and found out at that time about this issue of plastic floating in the Mandalay Ocean, which I had never heard about. And that's what sort of inspired, since I hadn't heard of it, I thought not many people probably had known about it. And that's what sort of got our first expedition going a few years back with Kaisei.
And for our listeners who are not familiar with the Pacific Gyre, why don't you explain what that is and how it's grown over the years?
Well, briefly, all oceans and water bodies have current flows, and it is that the big oceans, Pacific, Atlantic, Indian, have circulatory currents, which essentially work like a giant whirlpool in your bathtub or your sink. And so when those go around the continents, they tend to grab anything that's on the outer fringes that gets pushed into them, and maybe which doesn't get blown back into land. And in the past, no one's paid much attention, partly because not many people go out to these remote areas that are thousands of miles from shore. They're not on the shipping routes. Very few sailors go there because in the summers they're often void of wind, so there's no reason for people to go out there and monitor. But what people started finding, those who did go there, was that there's more and more and more garbage in that part of the world, and they wondered where it's coming from. And the fact is that when you have plastic that doesn't readily biodegrade and floats, then those things which get swirling around in this part of the water just keep swirling. And, you know, unfortunately, they break down and animals start eating them, whether it's birds or fish, and then some of them sink. And so this is what we were studying. And why is it growing? Some studies have shown or assume that the Atlantic side is not growing as much, and maybe that is because the last 20 or 30 years, both sides of the Atlantic Ocean governments have done a lot on litter control and litter management. But other parts of the world are still not quite doing those kind of litter projects, and they don't have the resources for recycling and waste management. And they're consuming more and more as populations grow, and that gets into riverways and gets out into the water system and the ocean. And that's the macro issue we're trying to slow down, basically.
And why don't you explain what the mission of the Ocean Recovery Alliance is?
The mission of Ocean Recovery Alliance is to really create new and innovative projects that bring together surprising ideas and collaborations. We work a lot with businesses and governments in order to bring them to the table, because we really need them to help scale the solutions. When you and I can do things like use less plastic when we shop and in the products we buy, we can recycle more. But to really get to scale impact, we really need large volume of these changes. And that's where companies and governments can get involved. So we're working, we have two projects of the Clinton Global Initiative that we announced. They're the two only projects that I know of that are global in scope around plastic pollution that any country can use, also without the need for bans or taxes or legislation, which inevitably always slow things down. And so by having these programs, it gets the business community or the consumer and general community engaged in a bigger way on waste management issues, particularly plastic, because paper and glass and metal organics can all relatively be treated as a recycled component. But plastic has so many variables with the different types of material, very hard to get economies of scale and to recycle it with all the different types and colors and weights. And it's the toughest challenge.
And what are microplastics?
So microplastics are the end result of big pieces of plastic. So plastic photodegrades, but it doesn't biodegrade, and except maybe hundreds or thousands of years later. So when you have something in the sun and a wave action, up against rocks or something, it gets brittle over time and it breaks down, just like your lawn chair furniture in the sun over a few years. And that becomes microplastic. So also you have small beads that are in many, many cosmetic products now for facial scrubs, even toothpaste will have tiny, tiny little synthetic beads, which are plastic and not natural. They used to be maybe the grinds of apricot seeds or something like that. And then companies figured out it's just much easier and also safer for allergy reasons to use plastic. And the problem is there's no water system, government, municipal water system in the world that can actually capture these little microplastics. Once you wash your face or use things out of the sink, they go into the water system. So those are pre-created plastic microplastics, but all the big pieces that you and I might see on the beach and are on the street or in a river that gets washed out will become a microplastic over time once it gets worn down.
And last time we spoke, you were just in the midst of another project that sent boats to the Pacific Gyre. I know it's 5 years later, but give us an update on the Gyre and what we know about it at this point.
Right. Well, that was really an interesting moment because we did the first study. We co-funded Scripps Oceanography to go with us on that trip, and that really brought the higher level of science to this topic than had existed before and got a lot of attention globally because we found plastic in every sample that we took over 3.5 weeks and thousands of miles of water. We also were the first group to ever sample at depth. Most of the groups had sampled only on the surface water, and we had the equipment to sample down to 700 meters deep, where we caught small fish, and we then analyzed those fish to see if they had any plastic impact. What we found was that 10% of those fish did have plastic, even the ones that don't go to the surface to feed, which means there's a three-dimensionality to this whole plastic problem. It's not just, you know, what you see on the beachfront or on floating on the water. In fact, almost 70% of all plastic that actually gets into the water will sink. So in a way, we're dealing just with the tip of the iceberg. And what we found after calculating the 10% of the small fish having plastic was that the population of the fish in that area, once the scientists calculated what that population might be, could be eating 12,000 to 24,000 tons of plastic a year. And that number was quite shocking. So what happens is you get the potential for bioaccumulation because small fish will get eaten by bigger fish and the bigger fish by bigger fish. And that potentially impacts our health. And the reason that does is because plastic in the ocean is an aggregator, almost like a little magnet for PCBs and heavy metals and fire retardants and agriculture pollutants, which come out of the water, which don't like the water and adhere themselves to a little petroleum product. So the dosages of this toxin on a piece of plastic is hundreds of times greater than on just the water itself. And so when a little fish eats that, it might get this little, you know, dose of these toxins, even though the plastic will go through the fish. And so this is what a lot of groups are looking at now and trying to understand the potential for transfer of toxins in the water because of the plastic, not necessarily because the plastic itself is bad, but because it's carrying things once it's been sitting in the water for some time. This really is what motivated us to then launch these other bigger global programs. So instead of really trying to remove everything ourselves, we're trying to go upstream, as you would say, and really address the issues at the city and company level, because at the end of the day, this is a waste management and a city issue. It's how we deal with our products and our waste. It's not the ocean that is, you know, creating the problem. It's our daily lives and our management of this material that is causing it to overflow, basically, and get into the waterways once we're done using it.
How much do I love you? I tell you no lie. Is the ocean? High is the sky? How many times a day do I think of you? How many roses sprinkled?
Follow the shift to sustainability with Sea Change Radio on Twitter at twitter.com/SeaChangeRadio and on our Facebook page.
This is Alex Wise on Sea Change Radio. I'm speaking to the founder of the Ocean Recovery Alliance, Doug Woodring, coming to you live from Hong Kong. So, Doug, are there any studies that you can point to or that scientists are highlighting at this point that tell us that the efforts that are underway in terms of municipal governments and other policymakers to reduce plastic use, like plastic bag bans, etc., if they're making an impact in places as far away as the North Pacific Gyre?
Well, that's a good question. And definitely the world, at least the Western world, has woken up to, you know, the issues of plastic waste. There are bag bans and bag taxes. They're proven to work, at least in those local places. What has not been done, and in many cases, the scale, again, is not particularly great enough. You might have a bag ban or a tax in one city, which helps that local environment. But to then extrapolate that to the middle of the ocean is very, very difficult to see that impact, because you've got an entire coastline of the U.S. that maybe doesn't have the same ban or tax. And there's a ways that material can still be getting in from other places. So it's a good start, but in reality, we use plastic in so many different products that changing one product and reducing it is just the tip of the iceberg, again, to use that term, of what we need to do to start change. We don't say that plastic is bad as a product. We all need it for so many different things. But we also greatly waste it in terms of disposable products and packaging. There's much low-hanging fruit, which can be removed, but then there's a lot of opportunities related to plastic as a material and a resource for recycling, potentially for fuel use in the right way. So we're really trying to motivate companies and governments to treat all of their waste as a big resource, not as something they just throw away and dump. And so I think that has not yet been seen, how that impact is going on a greater scale on a macro level yet.
Maybe you can give us some specific examples of these opportunities and then how they relate to your Clinton Global Initiative program.
Sure. So there's, generically, there's a term you might have heard is cradle to cradle, the circular economy. This basically means designing and creating products that are meant to be reused, not literally reused maybe, but re-put into the system so they're reground, reprocessed, and then another company uses that material, and that material just keeps running along. If you look at plastic and its durability, if you can break it down and reuse it, its reuse lifespan is many, many, many years, decades, depending how you reuse it. And so instead of creating all kinds of virgin material all the time, we really could be tapping into the vast inventory of plastic that already exists in our communities and reusing that. So one of our projects is called the Plastic Disclosure Project, and it's very much like carbon or water reporting. Most people now know what a carbon footprint is. They know how to look for their energy use and how much, you know, carbon they might be using as a result. We're trying to get companies and institutions to look at their plastic or their waste creation footprint, if you will, every year. Because if you don't measure what you have, it's hard to manage and it's hard to know how to get that into that circular economy, which many are talking about. So if you make something with 1,000 pieces, you should know what the weight is, what the volume is. You should also know how much actually gets recycled when it's done. Do the consumers bring it back to you? Do the consumers ever have any relation with you again and bringing that into the system, or do they just throw it away? Can that be changed? Can you put more recycled content in your materials when today maybe you're just using 100% pure virgin? So these kind of thinking is what our program gets people working on. It's just like carbon. At the beginning, carbon was simply about how much you use. And then people started realizing, wow, I can save money. I can reduce this. I can cut out that waste. I can make this more efficient. And that's what we're trying to generate on a big scale, because when you start doing that with plastic, then you can get large scale changes. You know, in some of these companies that are multinational, just one small packaging change in a material or a weight could have a very large impact on the total volume that actually gets out there into the world.
And are these consumer products generally? What are some of the low-hanging fruit specifically in terms of the repurposing, reusing of these kind of plastic materials? Is this from an industrial side of things, or are these just things that we'd find in a convenience store?
It's both and everything. I mean, all types of plastic literally have a way to be recycled. But the problem is that not many of our communities have the recycling capacity to handle every and all of those types, because there's so many. So when you get a bunch of candy wrappers and food products that are lightweight and hard to capture and hard to get into the system again, then they don't get dealt with, and they go to the bushes or the parks, or they're thrown on the ground and they're, you know, flushed out to sea when there's a big rain or wind. When you have industrial material, computer parts or car parts or chairs or something, that's bigger, heavier, it's easier for people to get and reuse, but it's not always happening. Again, it really depends what country you're in, because a lot of countries just do not have good systems. So everything can be done, basically. The low-hanging fruit would be a lot of this excess packaging in food and takeout products. We're very consumer and one-time use oriented, unfortunately. And when you use a straw or a stirrer for a coffee cup or a coffee lid, and we're not bringing those back, we're not thinking about it, those pieces will last potentially hundreds of years after you use it for 3 minutes. And that's a mismatch in material and our use of that product. And this is something we all collectively can really start thinking about how we improve on that. We just released the first ever report with the United Nations and Trucost on the natural capital cost of plastic to our environment. From the consumer goods industry, we looked at 100 listed consumer goods companies around the world, and we said, okay, how much do they use? How much maybe gets out into a waste stream? Very conservatively, that number came to $75 billion a year, which was the cost to the planet from using this material and not treating it or capturing it the right way. And the cost to the ocean was about $13 billion. And that was the first time that ever a number like this was placed on impacts in the ocean. Again, a very conservative number, because we were using publicly available data and scientific data, not of which a lot is actually existing in terms of the costs to the ecosystem or animals, fishing industry, tourism. Some of that exists, but not all of it. No, 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 it can't be true. No, 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 it isn't you. No, 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 it's not the way you are. No, 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 it isn't you. No, 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 it can't be true. No, 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 it's not the way you are.
To listen to Sea Change Radio anytime, anyplace, just subscribe to our free podcast. Simply follow the link from seachangeradio.com or search for us in the iTunes podcast directory.
This is Alex Wise on Sea Change Radio. I'm speaking to the founder of the Ocean Recovery Alliance, Doug Woodring. So, Doug, your organization is actually also involved in advocacy in trying to clean up Hong Kong's sewage treatment system. Is this specific to Hong Kong, or do you see this as a template for replicating in other areas where there's need for upgrading sewage systems? And maybe explain a little bit more in detail what you're actually trying to do. What's the problem with Hong Kong's current system?
Sure. So we're not trying to go directly to the sewage treatment, but as the Ocean Recovery Alliance, we're trying to help the ocean in many ways. So plastic, what we just talked about, is one of our main focuses. But I also, given my experience in the fishing industry, care a lot about illegal fishing, overfishing, sharks, all kinds of other issues that relate to ocean health. So unfortunately, in Hong Kong, last summer and in many summers, you get algae blooms or red tides. China has this as a huge problem. And so does much of the world. And when you either have agriculture runoff from countries as people, you know, the population's growing, countries are trying to produce more food, they're using more agriculture, pesticides and fertilizers, this gets into the water and that creates a nutrient mix that the algae like. All the algae bloom in the right scenario and suck all the oxygen out of the water, and then the fish die and the potential big problem in a dead zone in a whole territory of ocean or coastal water. And this happened last year in a couple big ways in Hong Kong. And it caused us to look at, you know, what is the scenario with the sewage treatment? And in fact, Hong Kong, though a lot of sewage is treated, only about 16% is treated at the what we would consider first world levels of treatment. And so that means that the amount of material getting into the water is not very well treated, and the sizes of what is put out are larger than normal, which means you have a nutrient count that probably is much higher than it should be, and that impacts ocean quality. So maybe Hong Kong is an example that other developing countries who do have sewage problems and tourism interests, because especially Southeast Asia, a lot of that is coastal areas really driven by tourism economies. That is very important to treat your water, both on the coastline and upriver, so that what goes out doesn't impact your reefs, doesn't impact your fishing, doesn't impact all of the things that dirty water would impact. And so we're just trying to raise that awareness level and support, in this case, support the government to proceed with their expansion plans for the sewage treatment that they had planned 15 years ago.
And then there's a subset of your sewage program called Great Art. Is that correct?
Yes, that's correct. So Great Art is helping storm drain systems. And many times that would go into a sewage system. But what Great Art is G-R-A-T-E. We're basically putting street art in the form of a small plaque next to the storm drains, next to the grate on the curb of the street. You'll see this in California and Australia, Hawaii and other places. It basically says, please don't dump in the drain because it will impact your fish. But they don't have that in Hong Kong, and they don't have it in probably 90% of the world. And so we're bringing together local artists and Chinese artists to create 8 really neat looking little plaques that will be ceramic plates glued to the street next to the drain, just to remind people not to dump there. And that's something that could really be replicated across the world in any city or town or country that, you know, would like to do something fun and creative like that to help the loading that goes into the water.
The founder of Ocean Recovery Alliance, Doug Woodring. Doug, thanks so much for being my guest on Sea Change Radio.
Thank you, Alex.
Sway the future to the past and find what will endure.
You've been listening to Sea Change Radio. Our intro music is by Sanford Lewis, and our outro music is by Alex Wise. Additional music by Ernest Ranglin, Eric Clapton, and John Martin. Check out our website at seachangeradio.com. That's seachangeradio.com to stream or download the show or subscribe to our podcast. Visit our archives there to hear from Bill McKibben, Van Jones, Paul Hawken, and many others. And tune in to Sea Change Radio next week
as we continue making connections for sustainability. For Sea Change Radio, I'm Alex Wise.